Good evening, welcome. Tonight we'll continue our exploration of the imaginary schools of the early tradition who cleave to things like unchanging real particles and the equivalent reality of the three times. But we'll begin with our chants as usual. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening, welcome. So, for tonight's class, we had reading. We dove into the book that we asked you all to obtain and read, The Golden Age of Indian Buddhist Philosophy, by Jan Westerhoff, who's quite an active and interesting Buddhist scholar these days, produced an enormous amount of very high quality, wonderful work. And it's a shame that he doesn't have a really good editor, isn't it? Anyway. So tonight we begin with bringing us into the frame by a little deeper dive into some of the charts of reality. Let's see. I think it'd be helpful to spend a few minutes getting familiar with the classification of the dharmas that we'll be traipsing around and talking about, what it seems to be the three main areas of interest in understanding the nature of this world that we believe in so fixedly, is things, what are real things, or the fact that we believe that things are real. If things are real, how does causation happen? And if there are our minds, how do they perceive? And we'll see the differences in the understanding of these two, and the two of the main Abhidharma schools, so-called schools, the Sarvastivada and the Sautrantika. And just want to, we'll go through this chart real quick, and then I'll segue over to my buddy Chris, who will talk to us about the framework of reality that we all believe in so deeply. So there's existent things and non-existent things. Chris mentioned this early on, but sort of magical innovation that the Abhidharma folks had in including non-existent non-things in their view of reality. These are things that are conceptual. And then this organization of reality is actually of reality presents a way of studying reality that's common now in the Shaidra tradition, which is starting with things as objects and then going to the subjects that perceive them, and then how subjects engage objects. And it's not specifically oriented for Abhidharma, but it has a nice little summary of the various groupings of dharmas which is very handy since with lists of 75, 79, 100, 108, I can otherwise get a little bit lost in the details. The forest for the trees, or something like that. We have forms. We divide them into three groups, and these are called the five bases: form, matter of various types, primary mind, and in the early tradition we have one, just mind, mental factors, which are different supporting functions or capabilities of minds. And then we have what are this odd thing called non-associated formations, which are things like life force, birth, sustenance, and decay, syllables, words, bizarre things. We'll look at the list of them. And then we have uncreated dharmas, nirvana, and cessation by virtue of running out of productive causation. And cessation that's caused by the path. So non-existent things are things like jackalopes, unicorns, and the self are famously non-existent things. So I'll pause there and ask Chris to flesh out a little bit the importance of realizing this framework of reality we believe in. Chris, how are you this evening?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you, Derek. So in our last class, we got a lot into the apparent contradictions and clunkiness of the Abhidharma systems, and just sort of nitpicking how these views lead to these problems. And I think it leads to the question of like, why bother? Why are we engaged in this enterprise of taking this stuff so technically? What does this have to do with our lives? And what the Abhidharmakas were doing was taking their world very seriously. They can be described as ascribing to a view known as realism, belief in a real world, a world that is independent of minds, a world that is shared, and a world that substantially exists. This sort of view is held by, I think, most people, that there's a real world out there, that when you get up out of bed, you put your feet on a real floor and walk into the real world. And what the Abhidharma project is doing with various degrees of ingenuity, really, is understanding how, trying to understand how that could work. Basically, if you're going to maintain a realist position, this is the philosophical price that you'll have to pay, this clunkiness. So by observing sort of how this system works or doesn't work can be very helpful in deconstructing our own commitments that we make, often unconsciously, to realism. And I'll pass it back to you, Derek.
You're
You're
muted,
muted.
Derek.
Could you all say that at once? Thank you. I wanted to just get a glimpse of like what they've thought the world or the world, the reality looked like. And it's really I think it helpful to have like a visual of how they thought the world, the universe appeared that they were trying to explain. So here's some nice examples briefly of that. Here's the world is, the universe is a circle, and it proceeds from the realm of form up into the realm of the, sorry, the realm of desire, where we live with the six realms of hell beings and hungry ghosts and animals and humans and so forth, up to the realms of form, and then which goes up to here, and then the formless realms. And this is a little bit of an awkward top-down view. And let's see, here's the detail on the realms, where you have the lower realms in the realm of desire, the hell, animals, hungry ghosts. Then you have the human realm, and then you have the blissful realms of the gods within the desire realm, Kamavachara. And then you have the Rupavachara, which is the form realms, and then the Arupavacharas, the formless realms up above. And so this is the universe that this makes up samsara, and that was their view, was that we all lived in samsara, which was basically a mind-made creation, as a little bit of a side view. And here's another maybe nicer side view. Oh, darn. Well, anyway, you can see that it exists in reality like this. And so the effort was how to explain that. And we have a progression from the Sarvastivadins, who claim that everything exists, as Chris talked about. They took everything as being equally real. And so once again, let's look at our Dharma charts. Sorry. Here we go. I did something weird to my screen. I can't seem to move it. I'm going to start over again. Form consists of the four great ones, earth, water, fire, wind, as causal form. And then we have resultant form, which is the forms of the subtle matter of the sense faculties that reside in the sense bases, the faculty being different than the bases, and then the objects of the forms. And then they have a handy category of non-form form or non-material form, which is a way of describing how the energy of things like vows, which are not form, but they can be obstructed by form. So they came, it's an interesting example of one of the difficulties they encountered and the clunkiness that Chris was talking about, and how they tried to solve that. The mental factors that support the primary mind have these different categories of faculties, virtuous forces, root afflictions, universally evil functions, and then minor afflictions and indeterminate functions that are neither positive nor negative. And the faculties are things like feeling and discrimination, attention, contact, aspiration, intellect, mindfulness, attention, inclination, and concentration. And these appear basically in every mind moment. The primary mind arises with this collection of supporting faculties that create the experience that we have of experiencing, of cognition, of perception or awareness. And then that's colored by various forces, virtuous or negative being root or universally evil or minor negative forces, and then indeterminate ones, which is an odd category because to most of us, I think they would seem quite determinate, but they can have, I guess, in their mind, things like hatred could have a good purpose, and raga, and love could have a good purpose, just as hatred might. And then we have non-associated formations, acquisition, which is a factor of how karma accrues to dharmas, and creates their impact on the next moment. Non-acquisition is how some dharmas or some situations or activities do not create propensities for future, presumably through awareness, things like that of dharma practice. The idea of similarity of phenomena. What an odd thing to be a dharma. Non-conceptual equipoise, unconscious equipoise, cessation equipoise. So three types of equanimity or equipoise, or meditative attainment without conception, or unconscious like a trance, and a cessation which is similar to nirvana but not quite. Then there's the thing, life force. Birth, sustenance, and decay. These are the three factors or three states that all dharmas manifest, and how they manifest those was a subject of great debate. The overall idea of impermanence, that things, that there's change. And we'll see some radical version of that today in the idea of dharmas as being phenomena, that real dharmas don't change, but are momentary. It's a very, very odd way of looking at reality, or answering that question of what's real and how do things function. Name is a dharma, sentences are dharmas. Or this is really syllables, I think. Or this maybe is sounds. But quite an odd assemblage of dharmas. I think if you or I were to do this, we might come up with slightly different ones. Here we have the 100 dharmas, just a quick look at what the Yogacara tradition came up with, which is ahead of us, but it has a classification that in some ways provides a simplicity which is helpful to us. We have again the different types of form. I'm sorry, let's start from the left. We have the minds, and instead of six consciousnesses, we have eight consciousness. Then we have the form element, and these are the sense bases, eye, ear, nose, and so forth. And the elements as objects of consciousness. So they have a very different version of the form elements, because in the Yogacara, matter is not externally real. It's not independently real. Everything is mind. So their view of form is unusual. They have the mental factors grouped in a little bit more of a helpful way. Omnipresent mental factors, feeling, discrimination, intention, application, and contact. And you see the Sanskrit of these. And these happen in every mind moment. The object determining factors happen in every moment where there's contact with an object, which is in every moment of experience, but implies that there are moments where there's not experience, such as the idea of the bhavanga, the resting state of mind, or the alaya vijnana. We have virtuous factors. And then we have the root afflictions, the kleshas, which we all know very well. And then we have secondary afflictions and a lot of those. And then variables or changeable mental factors that can go either way, sleep, remorse, investigation, and analysis. So, you know, you could be a very evil person and investigate very carefully, or a good person, so to speak, and investigate very carefully. Here we have view broken down. This is a helpful one to see. Becomes important in various places. That wrong view, one of the six root afflictions or kleshas, has five types. Viewing the skandhas as being in some way the home of the self. And they use this term, the transitory collection, to refer to the skandhas, holding it to an extreme of like existence or non-existence, which leads to, like, on the one hand, if you believe in nihilism or nihilism, you disregard karma. And if you believe in eternalism, you believe in fate, and that also karma is not as important. Holding to wrong views, that the Four Noble Truths are not accurate description of reality. And then holding any view as supreme, like my understanding of this or that is the end all and the be all. Or like doing some particular conduct, like making offerings or standing on one foot, is the supreme remedy to all ills. Let's see. There is a second page to this, which is the non-associated dharmas. And they group them with those that are related to the person. Acquisition. And persons refer to any sentient being. Life. Nature of common persons. We talked about this in the context of Bedford and trick-or-treating, annihilation, trance, birth, sustenance, becoming, impermanence, old age, result of the trances, thoughtless trance, shared qualities. This is a similarity we saw in the other chart, this idea of acquisition. And then those that are not related with a person, name, character, or letter, syllable, harmony, order, time, gathering of causes, non-existence of causes, number, direction, speed, distinction of causes and effects, and phrase. And lastly, the unconditioned dharmas. We have space, extinction through those two different ways that I said, intellectual power, the path, or like running out of fire and your fire is extinct, or extinction through the fourth absorption state, and extinction of sensation conception and the cessation of non-perception, and then suchness, the true nature of reality. So just to frame, like, I think the objective of that was to try to shift us out of the idea that the Abhidharma folks had a fixed belief in the reality of what they experienced, and that that reality was the same as ours. And I just want to emphasize that their reality was rather different. They believed there were all these different beings, all these different worlds, all these different realms, and that they described reality as having all these factors that were real entities. And we generally see a trend of going from, with the Sarvastivadin, this idea that, okay, everything that we find in this world really exists. But when they whittle that down, they end up saying, as the let's take a look at our text here. On the bottom of page 72. I'm sorry. On page 70, we have the introduction of this idea that there's two aspects to dharmas. There's their two existing things. There's their real essence or nature, their sort of reality as swabhava, as an essence of being this or that. But then there's this further sophistication, there's further subtlety of, well, some things have reality, have real existence that is efficacious. This idea of, we see on page 70 in the second main paragraph there, this word karitra. And this is a way that the Sarvastivadins deal with the quandary of things persisting through the three times. That swabhavas persist through the three times. And why doesn't the fire from yesterday provide light or heat? Morgan.
What's the label on this section?
Oh, for you digitoids. Yeah. Do you see the labels we have on the side of the page? It's Swabhava. Do you see those labels in the digital version?
I have a bunch of labels. Three times are mutually interdependent, possible responses, the notion of karitra.
Yeah. Notion of Karitra.
And we're under Swabhava.
So they have this idea that dharmas exist through the three times. And they assert this because th this is part of their explanation of how does karma work in the world? How does activity from past translate into having impact on the future? So some way of rationalizing that evident fact that things from the past have an impact on the current situation. And this division between a dharma swabhava, its essence, and its capability comes about by saying that only dharmas in the present have capability, and yet the dharmas of the past are perceptible but not capable of performing their function as our dharmas in the future. And I thought it would be helpful to pause on this issue. This is a level of subtlety that we have not yet really talked about in other courses. This idea of distinguishing dharmas into having these two characteristics. Chris, you want to flesh that out at all?
So the Swabhava is what endures over time. So when we talk about yesterday's fire and today's fire, the thing that makes them the same is their Swabhava, which is often talked about as some sort of immutable essence. And then we have their karitra, which only exists in the present. You can burn yourself on today's on the fire right now, but not on yesterday's fire. And I think this is very interesting. It's how the Sarvastivadins want to define the present, but it also seems to cut against their ideas about how causation works in the past. So we have this idea of the three times, which is important because it explains how past karma can affect the present. But then they also want to define objects existing in the present as what have causal efficacy. Does that make sense? So they want to give efficacy to events in the past. That's how karma from a past life can influence what happens now. But they also want to say that the present is distinguished by being the time in which things are causally efficacious.
So the present can be a causal, can function causally. And the past is a resultant situation.
And yet we have causes in the past, primarily karma, that can influence the present.
So in the present, the past exists as a result. And in the present, you guys are laughing.
So the present is a cause of the future.
The present is the cause of the future, that's right. And the past is the cause of the present. And the present is the result of the past. This is obvious stuff. Sorry, Steve.
When the past was present, it was efficacious.
Yes.
Well, it was present.
The next present, actually.
Yes.
And that continues.
And that's how the present
indefinitely. That's itself. How the present is efficacious and causes the future when the future is present.
Yes. Cynthia, did you have something?
Yeah, so what do people think of these two aspects of dharmas? This was new to us, Cynthia.
Well, this may be a really stupid question. Forgive me for that. But in talking about the two aspects, the svabhava, and I think what you said was that is what endures over time, or it's the immutable essence. So again, maybe I'm misunderstanding this, but if the immutable essence of fire, for example, is that it's hot, and in the present it can burn us, okay, that's the efficacy part, I guess, that it can have that effect. But what is a past fire? A past fire, it would seem to me, is not hot anymore. And so I don't see how that, where is that immutable essence?
Yeah, and the Sarvastivadins sort of aren't able to say. It's a handy philosophical tool in their toolbox, but it's not one that they're particularly able to pin down.
I have to admit, because I read through this stuff and some of it I understood, some of it I wasn't so sure about, but this hadn't smacked me in the face quite so clearly as now when we were discussing it, where it just seems like it doesn't make any sense, that it doesn't really, that Svabhava one doesn't seem like it holds water.
Yeah, can I just read this one paragraph and
sure.
Then go to you, Emily? So this is at the bottom of page 70 for those with the book, and sort of the next paragraph from what we were just looking at.
Yeah, in the
PDF.
In the Karitra section.
The relation of the two concepts, Svabhava and Karitra, is far from straightforward. On one hand, they cannot be the same, since the former exists throughout the three times, whereas the latter exists only in the present. Yet, they cannot be completely distinct either, since what makes the fire is the possession of its intrinsic properties, like heat. But if these are completely removed from the svabhava and only associated with the fire's efficacy, it is then unclear what role the intrinsic nature of fire still has to play. Fittingly, we find Abhidharma sources pointing out that one cannot say with any certainty that they are the same or different.
Yeah, what an interestingly bizarre idea. And Many of us have gone through many, many courses on Abhidharma where we've gone through the Vaibhashika or Sarvastivada school in great detail, and we've never seen reference to this before, which is sort of interesting and perhaps telling that this idea did not sort of persist through time as a viable presentation. Rob, what do you make of this?
Well, they're realists, right? I mean, that's where these guys are coming from. So the Svabhava seems like a kind of a reification.
Oh, definitely, yes.
So I guess it's just sort of like a conceptual way for them to, have a handle on, the solidity of everything.
Yeah, so let's go back to the things existing in the three times. Why do they assert that? Chris, did you
Yeah, so
listen?
this wasn't in the reading. We had this like terrible job of trying to figure out what the reading was going to be, and then ended up, it's too long in some places and leaves out anyway.
It
So
was agonizing.
like Derek and I are emailing each other like back and forth like ad nauseum about like we really need these 2 pages because they anyway. Okay, so. The Sarvastivadins, this is on the page on the page 61 for those of you with the book, and it's testimony is the sort of marginal name of it for the PDF users. Sarvastivadins present a number of arguments in support of the existence of these three times. A first argument is an argument from testimony. As the Buddha has stated that one of the motivations for striving for liberation is the experience of disgust with material things that have now passed away. We must assume that these things did exist in some way, otherwise, why would the Buddha be talking about them, to explain their causal efficacy in bringing about the present state of disenchantment with material existence.
You added just to interrupt. Sorry to
Yeah,
interrupt.
sorry, I added a comment.
You added the word "did," that these things did exist in some way to explain their causal efficacy in bringing.
Thank
But
you for that.
yeah, but I think it's like they still exist.
Right. Otherwise, why would the how would the Buddha, who, as we know, can tell no lies, why would he refer to them? How would he refer to them? No. A second consideration is based on the observation that moments of consciousness need to be based on an object that they are about. If there were no past entities, thoughts about these entities would be objectless and therefore could not exist.
Let's pause on that one. So this is a really interesting one. So thoughts about, this is not like direct perception through senses, which they explain how in this tradition.
Yeah, so this is thoughts about yesterday's lunch.
Right. So, but just to segue briefly, tell us the mode of perception, how they describe perception happening.
For them, perception is simultaneous.
Right. Yeah, you see something that exists now. You're experiencing nowness, right?
Yeah, so the Zoom screen in front of you, you're perceiving it live.
Yeah, so this is thoughts about something. So if we're thinking about what we just talked about a few minutes ago, those
What was it?
thoughts, those thoughts have the objects that, since those thoughts are actually real, we're in this real world of everything's real, they have to have real objects. And that object of a prior reality, or yesterday's lunch or whatever it is, needs to still exist in some way. What do you make of this, Emily?
Well, it's bringing up a question for me about this. Would they say that everything that's have ever existed still exists, or is it sort of like once
Yeah,
everyone stepped? Yeah, so
it's like a
every
lot
lunch
of
I've ever
stuff.
eaten. Yeah,
It's
and
just
everything
like,
that ever will exist also exists.
yes, it's all here, all at once, Stephen, yeah.
So, what about unicorns? If I think
Well,
about a
I think
unicorn.
that's why this is important, is because if the thought doesn't have an actual referent that it's referring to, yesterday's lunch, if yesterday's lunch doesn't exist anymore, then talking about unicorns and talking about yesterday's lunch are equally valid.
And unicorns were in the non-existent realm on that chart.
Right, that's why I mentioned it. If they were in the non-existent realm,
They're not
how
real phenomena.
they are not real phenomena. Well, nor
They
were
were
they.
never, nor they never were, right?
Right.
At least in this scenario of the world. Okay, so phenomena then, therefore they hold that phenomena exist through the three times. There's a couple of other arguments, right?
Right.
You want to continue?
So one is that karma, right, which we've discussed already. So karmic events in the past accrue karma. These have results in the future. And sometimes those results are very immediate, and sometimes they take lifetimes before they ripen.
Yeah, so he gives the author gives four arguments: testimony,
Right. Yeah.
which
So the second
is.
one is consciousness needs a presently existent object, which we were just sort of talking about.
Right. And testimony is his weird way of referring to like scripture, like authority of the Buddha, right? And then the third one is karmic responsibility.
But I think the Buddha is used as an example because he's particularly believable. Where I think testimony, if I told you about yesterday's lunch again, that's also testimony referring to a past object. So in some ways it feels like more like he's talking about memory or, just referring to the past. So then, yeah, then we've got karmic responsibility. And then the fourth one,
Yeah, go through that. I
the
didn't find
karmic.
that one very convincing. The three times is mutually interdependent.
Yeah, so I found this one very interesting, which is that past, present, and future are all defined in relationship to each other. Present exists as this line, but with the past on one side and the future on the other. So if the past and the future don't exist, then the present is sort of undefined.
Yeah, so those are the reasons that things exist through the three times. And on the next page, 63, with the tag, the notion of caritra, there appear to be a number of considerations that can be put in place in order to support the existence of the three times. Sorry, while there can. A major challenge the Sarvastivadin has to overcome is this necessity of accounting for the fact that past and future entities lack the power of entities that are present. The present glass of water can quench thirst, etc. The Sarvastivadins account for this by the theory of efficacy, caritra. Let's see. And he gives some further explanation of that. And then that branches into this idea that we're starting from, that dharmas have these two qualities of their essential nature, their swabhava, and their efficacy. And the essential nature of the swabhava persists through time, which is where I had started from on page 70. Which, let's see, for digital purposes, if you can keep going for a few pages, there's a section, let's see, direct perception and cognition. Do you find that? And then a section called Swabhava in the digital version. It's right before the Abhidharma notion of dharmas.
And you're referring, when you say section, you're referring to these sort of little captions in the margins.
Yeah, they're little notes, whereas some of them are like sectional that have numbers on them. I'm not sure how they appear in the digital version. Anyway, we have these two qualities. Svabhava. They use the term svabhava, so I'm on page 70 in the middle of this paragraph that begins, "While there's no enduring person, the Buddhists still need to find a way to account for karma." Different schools came up with different solutions. The Sarvastivan come up with the ingenious idea that is reflected in their name. They claim that dharmas do not arise from a non-existent future, become existent, and then, as they become past, vanish into non-existent. Rather, dharmas exist through all three times. We mentioned this earlier as the third of the four reasons for dharmas existing at three times in order to accommodate the blatant implausibility. I like the author's commentary on these things. To accommodate the blatant implausibility of this view, they had to introduce a couple of additional terms. They used the term svabhava to denote a constant essence persisting through the three times, which is the basis of differentiating between things. The various dharmas that we saw on the charts. But while past and present fire would have the same essence, svabhava, only the present fire would also have causal efficacy, kharavitra, a property produced by causes and conditions, which ensures the dharma is actually able to carry out its appointed function. This has the curious property that the dharma's svabhava, its essence, is actually not to be found in the properties we use to perceive it, the brightness, heat, and destructive power, since those are causal efficacy and so forth of the fire, something that manifests only in the present. But can it be part of the fire's temporal essence? So then we say, what is that temporal essence that's separate from?
Atemporal essence.
Ah, thank you. Unchanging essence.
Can I just jump in and say, like, as I think about this, I'm almost okay with this like worldview that there's, it's like I'm picturing all of these svabhavas like sort of there from beginningless time to endless time, and they exist and they're there, and then it's like in each present moment, a little efficacious sort of blip of it with all these qualities kind of pops up. I'm like almost okay with wrapping my head around that. But the problem that comes up for me with this way of imagining the universe is it implies there's some other additional thing that allows those little blips to pop up and have efficacy in the present moment. That's, I think, there needs to be some additional layer, some additional sort of ether or a place where qualities are hanging out, waiting to kind of pop up in the present moment. And that's almost the part that's the most problematic for me as I think about it, is this like, what then is that? You know, it's like every version of the, or there's almost a theistic element or a, and then there's something more beyond this or some, and so like as I'm sitting here really wrapping my head around it, I'm like, I'm actually almost okay with thinking of the universe this way. And not to do what Derek asked us not to do last week, but bringing up modern physics. I feel like the reasons we all keep doing this is that's kind of our, the understanding of the universe we've been raised with. And that almost lines up with some of what they're talking about here. But the problem, you do hit up against this wall where it's like there's all these unexplained pieces to it that just don't quite fit in. So it
Well,
just had to pop in
can't it just
there.
be that a thing in the past causes a new swabhava to fire up in the present? You know, I've got a lump of clay, and then in the past, and then at some point I throw it, and in the present now there's a pot.
But what the pot, the svabhava of the pot was always there, as well as the svabhava of the lump of clay. Right? Like
Well, I
the
mean,
pot
I
to,
guess
it's not like the
to get really
pot.
technical, the pot doesn't have a swabhava. You know, it's only the infinitesimally small dharmas that make up the clay. and the pot is a conceptual projection onto those.
Okay, right. So yesterday's lunch doesn't exist, only the
Not
like part of the
strictly
particles that
speaking.
made up the lunch
Yeah,
are
so
what have us with Baba.
that's the further gloss on what a dharma is, which we should go into
Right.
in a moment.
Right. Okay.
I like this effort to sort of visualize what is what are they how are they visualizing the world of like there's this the world is like a field of infinite potential where there's these essences of real dharmas that are always present. Whatever has been always will be, and then they're triggered somehow by the web of causes and conditions into causal efficacy, and then those there's like this wave of now like goes through this field of potential, triggering at each moment like a different set of causal of potentials into causal efficacy, which then reverberates into the future somehow. I don't know. It's an interesting exercise to try to imagine, like how are they actually seeing this in their world? Okay, so on page in the book, it's 71. In the digital, it's a section that in our side margin, there's a header that says the Abhidharma notion of dharmas. And the dharma is based on it's a term. Based on the root dhri, to hold or bear, something that holds its own characteristic, it's unique and remains unchangeable through the Dharma's existence. So we have this sort of contradiction of this unchangeable essence and the law of impermanence that we have to grapple with. And first, let's start with the criteria that for what makes a dharma. The first is mereological, and I only know this word because I ran across it before in one of the articles by this same author, and I looked it up. It means based on the logic of what makes you merry or not. No, just kidding. It's a logic based on things existing based on parts. Is that right?
And like relationship between parts and whole.
Parts and wholes,
Yeah,
whatever that means.
I had to look it up too, and my computer wouldn't tell me. It said word not found. I had to go to Google. And Google showed me. But yeah,
That's good.
the analysis of the relationship between parts and wholes.
Parts and
And
wholes.
it's the sort of analysis that we saw with Nagasena and the chariot, right? There's no chariot, there's just a bunch of parts.
Thank you. Bingo. That brings it into tangible reality. I also had to look up horology. Anyone else look up horology? I can't even remember what it was now.
This is timekeeping, the study of timekeeping.
Right. His use of these terms is somewhat comic. Okay, so mereological, something that has parts, and dharmas fundamentally have no parts. And he goes through this description of how they come up with a partless dharma, which is physical, material, coming to the fundamental particle of matter, and then also conceptual, that it's not based on designations. And we've seen this description incorporated into the Tibetan tradition's projection back onto the school and described numerous times of something where when you mentally dissect it, the idea of it falls apart, right? So let's see, this author says the second, more abstract, not physical but conceptual parts. If a thing disappears when dissolved by the mind, it can also cannot be regarded as a dharma, sorry. The example is he provides of a water animals. Adam, sorry. Such a partless particle is mereologically simple and therefore not ruled out by the first, so it's a essential particle.
And
But a
just to
water
be
atom
clear,
has different qualities: shape, color, stickiness, adhesive quality, and so forth. If we break the atom apart mentally, we're left with no water, but only with a conglomeration of properties that collectively characterized it. The only entities that qualify for dharmahood, love that, by this more stringent second criteria appear to be property instances, sometimes referred to as particularized properties or tropes. And he gives the he makes like the very simple example very complicated by introducing it that way, but the simple example is that the only real things that stand this test are this color, this blue color that you see on your screen or in your field of vision. This circular shape, so it gets to this idea that we talked about, I think, last class of specifically characterized dharmas, as opposed to generally characterized dharmas. And this leads into this idea that there's of what we call the two truths, or the two levels of reality. On the next page, there's a section called existential status. Oh, sorry. First, there's a section. The margin note says "Dravya and Prajnapti," and he uses these terms without giving the English later on. So, just to touch on them briefly, it's a paragraph that says the notion of Dharma and its existence by Swabhava is essential for establishing the Kiya Abhidharma distinction between those things that exist substantially, Dravya Sat, and it's important to note that substantial in our world refers to matter, but in this world, substantial applies equally to matter and mind, and it just means they are real, really there. They're verifiable through experience and so forth. And those that exist only as designations, mental imputations, prajnapti, sat. So dravya is truly existent, and prajnapti is conceptually imputed. So then the next paragraph, the existential status, is towards the end of that paragraph, he says, when we speak about the two, sorry, in the middle, according to this perspective, the distinction between the two truths boils down to the existence of a single truth, since only the entities that are fundamentally real exist at all. So the only realities are those that are dravyasat, substantially existent. They can be perceived, they have qualities, and they're not mentally designated. And those that are mentally designated are actually not realities. So he says there's only one level of reality. And this is prescient, I think, that you call it, or sort of it's something that comes up much later when we go through the Madhyamaka and other traditions, this idea, this way of taking the two truths. So I found it interesting that it was presented here, that there's really only one truth. And he quotes this text, the Abhidharma Mahavibhasha, their Bible. There's indeed only one truth, the absolute. The two truths are established in terms of difference in perspective, not in terms of real entities. In terms of real entities, there's only one truth, the absolute truth. And presumably the term absolute truth, it's a little unclear to me what that's translational, but maybe Dravya Sat, I'm not sure. In terms of difference in perspective, the two truths, types of truth are established. So the difference in perspective depends on who is looking. Ultimate is the way of enlightened beings, and conventional is that way, that which is reflected in the way ordinary beings conceive of it, which is so similar to what we'll see later on. Chris, did you want to add anything here? Otherwise, Rob had his hand up.
No.
Rob, do
So,
you have a comment?
just to be clear, they're saying that our conceptual overlay, our constant conceptual overlay is not real.
Right.
But they still speak of it in terms of the two truths, and not so dissimilarly from the way later traditions use it. You know, the two truths, a conventional way of speaking in which things can be true or false relatively, but not ultimately. We can talk about yesterday's lunch. We can have a meaningful conversation about yesterday's lunch, even though on an ultimate level, the only thing that exists are these little atoms out of which lunch is made.
Right, but it's actually, you know, this is like a pre-Mahayana school, right?
Yes.
So, you know, I think it's kind of sophisticated that they're already going that, you know, that they're already recognizing that, you know, it's our self-talk that's changing, our perception of what's real.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that. Right.
Yeah. That's very. We'll see this coming through big time with the Madhyamaka school.
Right. So like that. So that you can. It's like the seeds, the karmic seeds for Madhyamaka, are being planted in many ways.
Many ways. Yeah. In some ways, it's not a huge leap. It's just sort of like the what you guys have been saying all along, but you're still holding on to the. To all the details and all the categories and all the lists.
And the Mahayanists will go to great pains to demonstrate that, you know, they're not making a huge leap, that all this stuff is in the original teachings of the Buddha.
Yeah, we'll see that all the way through to the Vajrayana, the Tibetan traditions, the Vajrayana views, and the we'll learn about it, the Zhentong view. They have the same idea that it's all there. It's been all there through the whole time. Emily, and then we'll shift to Sao Trautukus.
I think I read this in here. Are these guys saying that the partless particles are like made up of one of the four elements and that those are real? Was there something about that? I'm still trying to wrap my head around what characteristics.
You know, yeah, they were vague on that. You know, they didn't drill into that. There's other texts where we've seen descriptions of part of these fundamental particles as actually being made up of a minimum of seven or eight particles, one for each of the four great elements, and then one for four of the five senses. And I think they leave out auditory or something.
But as far as what the, you know, atoms are made out of, they're made out of that list of, you know, the 100 or the 75 or the 82, depending on which list you're looking at, dharmas.
But those are you know, so it's a struggle to explain, how do we get from a partless particle to those dharmas on that list? And those dharmas are considered to be conglomerates. And they have a whole way of describing conglomeration. And like
molecules,
yeah. And it's like a molecule of hatred. Well, not of hate, those are mental, but a molecule of subtle matter that makes up the eye faculty, or molecule of the eye object.
But if those are conglomerations, aren't they not dharmas by their own characteristic of, you know, description of what makes dharma?
That's right. And they use the term dharma. That is a very big contradiction in their world, I think, because that is very true. And it's bizarre. Also, what they say is that the dharmas all have that makeup. They all have these seven like subparticles that make up an partless particle, which is absurdly illogical. And that, let's say, a molecule of water will have a predominance of the water subparticles. But the other particles are all there in just a minority. You know, it becomes just really hard for them to describe how this whole thing comes together.
But again, just to refer back to what I said at the beginning of the class, you may not share this worldview of this particular flavor of realism, but like an allegiance to realism, you will have to pay similar prices to what we're looking at here.
That's the key element. One way or another, if you're trying to like conceptualize a system for what is really there, that you believe is really there, it's going to have these incongruencies. So Trantika, we're short on time because I wasn't that efficient early on. Sorry.
Yeah, I guess I'm gonna just try and race through their theory of momentariness.
How did we get from impermanence to momentariness, Chris?
Right. So impermanence, is basic Buddhist doctrine and one of the three marks of existence, and something that all Buddhist schools will share. And we'll have different ways of cashing it out. So the Satantrikas are very clear that they seem to come. The Satantrikas emerge in response to the Sarvastivadins, but they reject some of their basic premises, such as the existence of the three times. So they have what's known as the doctrine of momentariness. So I'm on page 75. For those of you with the PDF, the margin note is momentariness. And it's the second sentence of the second paragraph. According to the exposition of Satantrika, we find in Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya, everything lasts only for a moment. Not only do past and future entities fail to exist in any substantial way, the present also does not possess any temporal thickness. Immediately after coming into existence, each moment passes out of existence. So temporal thickness would be like the Theravadin view, where every moment has a rising, a persisting, and a fading away. He calls this cinematographic conception of reality. I sometimes think of it as like a flip book, of these individual moments that you flip through, which create the illusion of movement and continuity. The last sentence in that paragraph, individual dharmas succeed each other like frames in a movie and blur into each other because our perception lacks the temporal discrimination necessary to tell them apart. So how do we get here? So the first premise is the idea that everything is impermanent, a position that is, of course, well supported by the Buddha's theory of the three marks of existence. That doesn't necessarily get us to momentariness, right? So all things could last for, say, a minute rather than just 1 second or, a fraction of a second. If everything eventually perishes, what brings this about in each particular case? There may be an external cause operating on each object, moving it from existence to non-existence. This is sort of what Emily was talking about. That's somewhat related to what Emily was talking about. An external cause operating on each object, moving it from existence to non-existence. So the example he gives later is an external cause, a brick is operated on a window, and now the window no longer exists, right? Or each object may eventually destroy itself without any external influence, and that would be sort of the end of a candle snuffing itself out once it's out of fuel. The first possibility seems to be what accords, the first possibility being something ends something else. The first possibility seems to be what accords most closely with the manifest image of the world, where windows are shattered, flowers wither, and humans die, all because of the influence of external causes. Those causes he lists as the brick, the heat withering the flowers, or the tumor in the brain causing the human to die. Yet there are difficulties with conceptualizing these as causing non-existence, unless we assume that non-existences are real objects, first-class ontological citizens of the world, and not merely linguistic hypostatizations, as the Buddhists assume. So how does that cash out? So the question is, how does a brick produce the effect of non-window? So one option would be that non-window is a real thing that is produced by a brick. And this is actually a view that was held by a Hindu school, the Nyaya, who believed that absences were real things that existed. So there's a implicit critique of Nyaya in there. The Sautantrikas don't accept that absences are real. Absences belong to that first break in the graph we looked at earlier of non-existent things, along with jackalopes and unicorns. Okay, so no, sorry. The second premise of the argument is therefore the claim that this particular non-existence are not things that can stand in causal relations. When something causes the non-existence of something else, there is no thing that is causally brought into existence. There's no broken window or non-window that the brick brings into existence. So there's two options. One is to argue that absences are just language-based constructions, and nothing perishes at all. There is simply a transformation of the window, but nothing ceases to exist. We merely label the transformed object in a new way. Like the clay pot we were talking about earlier, the window is a conceptual projection onto these dharmas, and they just simply change their way of arrangement. Alternatively, even if some X really did go out of existence rather than being transformed into something else, what the cause has brought about is the total state of affairs that does not include X. So the total state of affairs would mean that the brick caused like a world in which that window doesn't exist, which seems a little fabulous. Or alternatively, the last succession of moments that constitute X. So that would be that the brick causes the last moment of the window, and then the window then causes its own extinction. Yeah? Rob.
My question is, okay, I get a brick breaking a window, that happens every day, but how do they explain the momentariness of that brick appearing and disappearing while it's flying through the air and the window appearing and disappearing until it gets hit? The momentariness. What causes momentariness?
Yeah, so we're getting there. We're getting there.
How is that ontological?
That is the question. That is
Yeah,
the question.
this
Well
is the
said.
buildup for. So we're what we just looked at is different examples, not particularly satisfactory, of how things can come to an end. Either they end themselves, or they're ended by something. They persist over time, and then they end themselves, or something else ends them. And we're seeing that's a little funny, the way that those could work. Going on to the next paragraph. If we hold on to the assumption that things really perish, that everything eventually self-destructs without the need, sorry. If we hold on to the assumption that things really perish, the second possibility, that everything eventually self-destructs without the need for outside influence is the one to follow. So the idea that just like a candle snuffing itself out, a window in some way, the cause of the broken window, while the brick is a factor contributing to it, the window is what causes its own destruction. Otherwise, you have bricks causing, otherwise, somehow miraculously out of a brick, you have a broken window kind of springing out of it. Does that make sense? Why that wouldn't work?
It does, but we're still not on, as Rob said, there's a large difference between that and it happening every moment.
Sure. Okay. So I'm gonna leave this and skip to the next page. And this is page 77, and the margin note is three kinds of arguments for momentariness. Within the Buddhist philosophical tradition, we can distinguish at least three kinds of arguments developed for establishing momentariness. We have just met the first, which we might call the argument for the spontaneity of destruction. We will discuss the other two, an argument from the momentariness of cognition and an argument from change later on. Forms of all three arguments make their reappearance in different guises at different stages in Buddhist philosophy.
Can you pause there?
Yeah.
And so he says, we've just met the first, which we might call the argument from the spontaneity of destruction. And go to the paragraph before that.
Sure. But in this case?
Yeah.
But in this case, and if dharmas cannot change, we have no choice but to pick the alternative, namely that the destruction is the result of a thing's inner nature, and that this destruction happens immediately once the thing is produced, since there is no ontological space for any mechanism that could cause the delay. So one of the definitions of dharmas is they don't have any parts, right? So if a dharma has a thing in it that causes it to go out of existence in the future, then it's not a dharma because it has two parts. There's the thing, and then there's the thing that makes it stop. Yeah.
So earlier we saw that fire had properties of illumination and brilliance and heat and burning and things like that.
Right.
Couldn't it just have another quality?
Well, again, we're back at the question of conglomerates versus, you know, basic dharmas. So a conglomerate, you know, and he gives the example of a watch, a spring-loaded watch. So, you know, the watch, as long as the spring is loaded, the watch continues to tick. But once the spring is, you know, unwound, it loses its ability to do so. Suggesting that maybe there's something in a dharma like that. But because a dharma can't have a part, a watch can have a spring, but a dharma can't have a part.
So this
it
is
can't
the,
be part of a dharma that brings it out of existence.
Yeah, so more on that, I think, is that it wasn't well clarified, I think, that... So when he says, but in this case, and if dharmas cannot change. So we're talking about the destruction of... How self-destruction comes about, but we know that dharmas can't change. So we're talking about destruction of what? We're talking about destruction of conglomerates, right? So is the conclusion that change only happens to conglomerates, and that dharmas don't change, and that conglomerates change momentarily? That seems to be like a big part of it that I didn't find clearly. Am I making something up? Did anyone else have that question?
Yeah. Absolutely. But you're figuring it out live in real time right now is helping me figure it out. Thank you.
Yes, so, and the page before... On 75, where you started with momentariness, the theory of momentariness therefore claims that all constituents of the world, all dharmas, only last for an instant and cease immediately after arising. And then he says, if dharmas cannot change.
Well, I think the point is that dharmas can't change within an instant. Dharmas do not persist over time, right? This is what distinguishes them from the Sarvastivadins. For them, dharmas exist only for a moment, and then they disappear. So they and there's no thickness to that. They arise and disappear in a single instant.
But then, what does it mean when he says dharmas cannot change?
So does that mean that they can't change in terms of their so-called nature, but they can change in terms of their existence or not? In terms of that they can arise and cease, but whatever it is that's arising and ceasing cannot change in nature.
One dharma causes the next, a dharma at time one causes a similar dharma at time two, but they're not the same dharma. The dharma at time one is gone.
So he never talks about that. He never addresses this whole issue, and he never says what you just said that I could find, did he?
Those tables and charts are listing dharmas, right? The 100 and the 75 and all of those, right?
Yeah.
So in terms of, I think if I'm understanding anything, which probably is not true, but But what you were just saying, Chris, is that, if no dharma ever, like, if each dharma in every moment were different, you wouldn't have charts of 100, you'd have charts of gazillions. So what we're talking about is a dharma of a particular type arises and ceases and arises and ceases. And that's why you could have only hundreds of types rather than gazillions of types.
I'm not following why the gazillions would be implied by
Well,
the.
if you were saying, I may be misunderstanding what you were saying, but you're saying that it's not the same dharma the next time it arises. I, in a sense, understand what you're saying, but it's the same type of dharma in
So
a different
that okay,
moment,
so
right?
okay. Again, we're at the particular versus generals, right? So the generally the dharmas on the list are general dharmas, blue, and then an individual dharma, this blue, is a particular dharma. So particular dharma blue at time one causes the next moment of particular dharma blue at time two. Those are different dharmas.
Right, but they are of the same
They're
type
of the
of
same
dharma.
type, the same trope.
So do they have the same essence, essentially, other than, but they have a different temporal momentariness?
I think you could say in a sense, but in a sense they do, because they're
Otherwise, they'd
instantiating
have
the
to be
same
different
property,
dharmas,
but
right?
they don't have the same essence because one exists and one doesn't.
Oh, wait a second. And what is. Okay. Well, I don't know if I can.
But I think you're sort of demonstrating the appeal of the Sarvastivadin view, because we do like to talk about a thing in the present sharing something with a thing in the past, and the Sautantrikas are saying, no, you can't do that.
So then what would they're saying there is no sorry. They don't, the essence idea or the having a dharma's having a particular qualities or whatever does not exist in their view.
They have an essence, but they have it only for an instant. The existence of that essence doesn't persist over time.
And it doesn't come up again in the next occurrence of that dharma in time two.
Another dharma comes up at time two, and they look the same because we lack the perceptual ability to see them as different.
This is where it seems like those tables would have gazillions in that case. That's what I'm was meaning by that. It seems
Well, yeah, I mean, so if you take the table to be an accounting of, all of the atoms in the universe, yeah, it would be very large. The periodic table, for example. Periodic table gives you all of the different types of atoms, right? It doesn't list every atom in the universe.
right, and that's but still the it's that's why I don't know why it's the Svabhava that makes the difference. Anyway, I think Emily and Mary Beth both wanted to say something, so I don't want to overdo this question.
Yeah,
I
Mary
just
Beth.
wondered what happened to the efficacy? What happened to the caritra? Did we lose that because we've moved on from the Sarvastivadins to the Sautrantikas? Is that what happened
It
also?
seems to have disappeared, but I was wondering that too. Is appearing the caritra of the Dharma, and their essence persists. Is when he says dharmas don't change, their swabhava doesn't change, but they go through a series of momentary appearances, which is their efficacy. Their efficacy is based on appearing, or as demonstrated, or as characterized, or whatever. But
I
yeah,
think
he did
it
talk
could
about
be
it.
that to the Sautantrikas that distinction collapses, that its essence and its efficacy exists together in the present moment.
So then we just lost Svabhava persisting through time,
Yeah,
but
that's
not
correct.
efficacy
Yeah,
in the moment.
Svabhava does not persist through time.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm still.
because there's only momentariness.
And efficacy in the present moment only. Okay.
Was With both of these systems, I'm still struggling to understand the relationship between characteristics and Svabhava. It's not like in the Svatantrikas, they are saying the Svabhava is not the characteristics, it's just the efficacy, right? So then are
No, I think they're saying that Svabhava is the essence that has those properties.
I thought the
It was
characteristics
confused.
were, yeah, this is what's kind of melting my mind with these, because I'm trying to understand where characteristics come in to
Well,
play and what
we've got
relationship.
a great essay in 2 weeks for you about
Great.
Svabhava. But it's from the
But
Madhyamaka point of view.
in all instances here, it seems like you can't have characteristics without some kind of, like, characteristics rely on the perceiver. They're completely relational. Would they have acknowledged that? Like, I feel like that feels clear to me, but that's
Well,
what I know to mean.
you could have a fire burning and no one perceiving it, and that fire is still hot.
But hot doesn't mean anything unless it feels hot to somebody. You know what I mean? Or something. Like, or blue doesn't mean anything
Well,
unless it's
you
observed.
could define it functionally, right? The fire has the capacity to burn whether someone's watching it or not.
But unless it's burning something else, there's no that, like, I don't think of those as inherent to, I think of them as completely relational in the same way that something isn't blue, whether someone sees it or not, because it's only blue. It only looks blue to, like, my eyes, but, like, to an animal that sees a different light spectrum, for example, it doesn't look blue. It looks different. So
But
it's,
I don't think that was totally part of their view. I mean,
well, that's what I,
they thought of view blue as, some color as a foundational dharma.
that's what I'm confused about from this reading. I did not get that sense, but is that
Well, that's
so?
on that, right, Derek? That's on the chart.
Well, you and I are constantly pulling in knowledge of Abhidharma that we've gleaned from other systems and or other presentations of it. And it's very hard to piece together his presentation because it has all these gaps in it. And yeah, it's definitely confusing. I mean, it's interesting that he enters in all these other aspects like Kraritra. And he goes through the arguments in a fairly clear way, but the whole thing doesn't hang. So causation, the intrinsic, so I'm back on 66, causality, centrality of causation, the intrinsic nature, Svabhava, of the ultimately existent dharmas is causally produced, which says to me that they don't exist and then they exist.
Well,
But
not to put modern physics into this, but it sounds like a lot of words just describing flux.
there's this contradiction between production and change, or existence and change. Like he says, dharmas don't change. So it's like they're produced, they subsist, and they destruct, but they don't change.
Well,
I think that's a big part of this that isn't explained.
if we go back to the film reel analogy, in what do you call that? What do you call it? An individual frame in a film? A frame, yeah. So in frame one, nothing changes within that frame. And then at the next frame, you have a slightly different thing, and the next frame you have a slightly different thing. So there's this appearance of change, but within each frame, nothing changes. So I think that's what he means by saying dharmas don't change.
I think so too, which is not explained. But it's like there's a difference between being produced and change. And for us in common language, being produced means going from a change because we think that a thing goes through the state from the state of unproduced to the state of produced.
Wait, I have a question about that frame thing that you seem to like. it's a nice analogy, but in that description of, you know, frame one, frame two, whatever, which of those is, where is the Dharma in those?
Whatever
the Dharmas
appears.
Are the contents of the frame on a atomic level.
And so whatever appears on the frame in each moment are the Dharmas, and then they destruct, which is, in their language, is different from changing.
And then something re-arises. But the thing is that, we're, I mean, I guess, not to be too literal, but in the movie example, what we're talking about is this illusion that's that creates the movie, is that there's frame one, and then there's frame two, which is slightly different than frame one, and then frame three, which is slightly different than frame two, right? They're just slightly different, slightly different, slightly different, and when you run them really fast, it looks like it's a nice smooth thing, right?
Why would there be a difference in each frame? Something happened that made the assemblage of dharmas different in each frame.
Okay, well, I mean, but I'm just, okay, I'm trying to be simplistic here of just, again, which, the dharma is a one, you're imagining the dharma is one frame.
The dharma is like all of the contents that make,
yeah, the contents make up the frame. In the frame.
It's not the frame itself, but it's, you know, you could say like the pixels of the frame.
The frame is a image of the real
dharma. The universe. The frame is the universe.
And captured by film.
Right. Or even if it's just, let's say, the picture of the window or whatever, you know, and so it's all the pixels that make that up are the dharmas. So mm-hmm. then the dharmas are getting rearranged in each frame. Mm-hmm. But the
dharmas are not on the film. The dharmas are impressed on the film. The dharmas are out there, no?
I think the film is made of the dharmas.
I guess the question is just that we're talking about, like, the change part is what I'm trying to figure out. Is it, like I said, in the film analogy, we know that it's an illusion. You've got all these separate things, you tie them together fast, and it creates this illusion. But in terms mm-hmm. of, if we're trying to explain how this, you know, like the house that we're in is still standing, even though it's momentary, that mm-hmm. somehow it exists and then ceases to exist momentarily and then somehow exists. Is that the level of momentariness we're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Higher level mm-hmm. constructs, right?
And why do they all cease to exist at the same time? Anyway,
yeah,
Emily.
So for the Theravadins, right, they don't, which is kind of funny. It's like a matter moment is 16 mind moments, which fits into their conception of epistemology about how you can see a thing and then perceive it because the mind moves faster than the change of physical matter.
Right, so every moment, some things that were there last moment aren't there. So there's some things that are missing. Like you only have four fingers, and then it's back. Emily.
I just, the other thing with this, you know, to extend the film metaphor, there's this essential piece to it, which is that there is a thing, like a machine, that makes them move really fast. And that's what makes the illusion appear. So, like, to keep going with that analogy, like, or what's the correlate? What level of reality or existence does, like, what is causing the frames to move? Well, yeah, like Cynthia's saying, the mind, which would be the Yogacara. Reading through all this, I can see why you end up at a mind-only place with this stuff, but that's like, feels like a big missing component.
What causes the next frame is the question.
Yeah, or like, what's, for lack of another word, what's the projector? In the, like, what is,
where
do
the frames appear? Where do the frames
appear?
Yeah,
and what's making them all run together, like, move along so that they
I think in this that the projector, or, you know, is the universe, is what's real, is the real world.
But then that's outside. See, it's a similar issue with a lot of these systems. That implies that there's sort of two things here. There's like all the stuff that's happening and then the thing that's holding it. And it's
Yeah, I mean,
all,
I
you
think
know,
we're
it's
running
like
up against the limits of the film metaphor of rather
analogy,
two
yeah.
things. For them,
But I think
it's
it's
there's one
relevant
thing,
too.
there's the dharmas, and the dharmas are sort of self-perpetuating. They
But see,
cause the next moment of themselves.
that's why I think the film analogy, even though it sounds like we're just hitting up against it, it's valuable because, like, the running of them, to me, it feels just as important to figure out the reality, levels of reality of that, as it is to figure out the levels of reality of the, like, frames themselves or the little units themselves. And, you know, you can't, it's like, it's not, it can't just be this closed system without some other external something
Well, I
causing things
think
to
for them,
flow.
it's they just take it as granted that a dharma at one instance causes the next moment of a similar type of dharma. They take that as just a quality of the dharma that it has the ability to cause itself at the next moment or something similar.
So, question about that, and there was something about this in the reading, is that if the dharma of moment one disappears, how can it cause the dharmas of moment two?
Well, yeah, there you're back at the standard question of cause and effect, right?
So what's like, how do they bridge the gap? And I don't think there's a satisfactory answer for that.
I think what's going on is that they had a view of what their world was, and they tried to encapsulate that as well as they could in various concepts and categories that ultimately were helpful in their past quality of breaking down attachment to a sense of continuity and agentness of the self. And it left numerous strands hanging out in space that really don't come together completely.
I just wanted to say something relative to what Emily was asking, though. It seems like that question kind of points to sort of two directions. One is obviously to the future schools where they go with the mind only, you know, that the mind is the projector essentially. And so that's one sort of direction that points. Or the other one, which is what Chris was talking about, is the dharmas, there's no external, there is no projector. There's no large scale phenomena that's making it all happen. That's where the film analogy definitely does break down, I think, because there isn't a whirring machine. This notion that the Dharma is just, you know, one turns into the next to the next, so it's sort of more of a grassroots operation rather than a sort of top down big machine kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, so I think we'll try to sort of map out what are the main elements of the system, and maybe where does it succeed and where does it fail. And we have one more class on the Abhidharma system, and we in this excruciating process of weeding out and making the readings manageable, we left out a wonderful presentation on how perception happens, and maybe we'll, I don't know, add that back in or something. But anyway, we should conclude. We're past our time. So we'll return to all of these topics with further information from next week's reading. Next week. Thank you, Chris, for that moment.
Thank you, Derek.
Series of moments. I don't know what it was, but by this merit may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old days, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings by the confidence of the golden sun of the great east. May the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. That was fun. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank
And
you. Good night, everyone.
feast. Have a good week. Take care.
Thank you.